Welcome to Soundings, a program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Major support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional funding from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas.
Burlesque and American Culture, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for a conversation about a pivotal chapter in the history of American popular entertainment. You'll hear from Robert Allen of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Robert Allen's new book is Horrible Prettiness, an account of burlesque and American culture, published earlier this year by the University of North Carolina Press. According to Robert Allen, the emergence of burlesque during the 19th century transformed popular entertainment in the United States. Because it transgressed standards of feminine behavior and appearance, burlesque also posed a threat to middle-class social relations. Robert Allen's book begins with an account of Lydia Thompson and her British Blondes, a controversial female troupe that came to American shores in the late 1860s. Robert Allen.
Lydia Thompson had been a star of British burlesque for several years before coming to the United States in the fall of 1868. Burlesque in Victorian Britain meant theatrical productions that were takeoffs of works of high culture, venerated middle-class culture. They were combined with all sorts of spectacle, dancing, singing, a real melange of all different kinds of styles. What separated burlesque from other kinds of theater in Great Britain was the increasing use of women in principal roles in burlesque to play both male and female characters.
All right, now did this transformation of the woman on the stage, is that a peculiarly American product? Did it happen because burlesque came to the New World, so to speak?
It certainly accelerated and gave direction to a trend that had been going on in American theater for some decades prior to the late 1860s. Mm-hmm. What American audiences saw when Lydia Thompson came to New York in the fall of 1868 was something that was both very familiar and something that was quite different.
Tell me about Ixion. What was that all about?
Ixion was the name of the burlesque that Lydia Thompson and her troupe performed in their debut performance at Wood's Menagerie and Theater on 30th Street and Broadway in New York City in September of 1868. It was an English burlesque that had been written 5 years earlier, which was a takeoff on Greek mythology. Mm-hmm. It took a story that would have been familiar to most school children in Great Britain and perhaps in the United States, of the King of Thessaly who was overthrown by his wife and escaped to Mount Olympus to seek the aid of Jupiter. Only in the burlesque version, Ixion had lost all his money at the racetrack, and he sought succor in Mount Olympus, where he found a whiskey distillery.
Oh my goodness.
And he falls in love with Jupiter's wife Juno and has to be rescued from entanglements there. Uh-huh. And is bound to a ship's wheel at the end of the play and makes an appeal to the audience, making a pun on the word wheel, W-H-E-E-L-W-E-A-L.
So this interplay between high and low culture is really nothing new. I mean, we have a lot of people who lament the decline of high culture in the United States and the ascendancy of pop culture. Here we're going back, 130 years or so, and you're telling me about the same thing.
Yes, indeed. And in fact, burlesque, American burlesque, had been popular for 20 years before Lydia Thompson ever got to the United States. Mm-hmm. Burlesque tended to be, however, a more male-dominated form in the United States.
Well, that's eventually what it came back to, as I understand it, but we're getting ahead of ourselves in the story. Bobby Allen, differentiate for me between burlesque and vaudeville. How does that work?
Vaudeville and burlesque were both forms of popular entertainment that arose in the period after the Civil War, from about 1870 to 1900. Vaudeville grew out of entertainments performed in bars and saloons to keep the customers in a drinking mood.
Men, I take it.
Mostly men, yes. Uh-huh. Vaudeville also grew out of dime museums, where in addition to the living and inanimate curiosities, there were various song and dance acts performed. Vaudeville was a name that was given to this form of singing, dancing, eclectic entertainment. When it was finally brought together in a systematic way in the 1880s and 1890s and performed in purpose-built theaters for middle-class audiences, the B.F. Keith chain of theaters was the best-known vaudeville chain in the United States. Vaudeville was, in the Keith theaters, called the Sunday school circuit because you couldn't say anything on a Keith stage that you wouldn't say at a Sunday school picnic. So vaudeville presented a series of 8 to 10 disconnected acts, mm-hmm. everything from monologists to comics to animal acts to jugglers.
Now, the Ed Sullivan Show.
Yes, the closest thing that we have to vaudeville today that people will still remember, this generation, is the old Ed Sullivan Show. Vaudeville was Ed Sullivan without Ed Sullivan, basically.
Right. Uh-huh.
And it was an enormously successful form of popular entertainment for middle class theater goers around the turn of the century.
All right, now burlesque, though, with that I associate the risque, the low life. Which comes first, in fact?
Well, certainly our popular memory of burlesque. If you ask the average American what burlesque is or was, and it would be in the past tense since there is no burlesque today. His memory, and it is likely to be his rather than her memory of burlesque, would have been as burlesque was in its dying moments in the 1930s and 40s.
The striptease.
The striptease. Minsky's burlesque in New York and other cities was best remembered. Burlesque in its latter days consisted of basically women who took their clothes off with assorted comics and singers to fill out the act. What's fascinating to me about burlesque is that it begins in America with Lydia Thompson in 1868 as a middle-class form of popular entertainment.
And she was fully clothed.
She was fully clothed.
Mainly clothed.
She was clothed from neck to toe. Uh-huh. Certainly you couldn't see any skin from neck to toe. She wore what was for the time a rather abbreviated costume.
Mm-hmm.
But it was an abbreviated costume that was an impersonation of masculine attire. Because in burlesque, women played both men's and women's roles.
All right, now that leads to this whole question of inversion and subordination and ridicule and the reversal of roles, as it were. Not only the reversal, but the establishment of a feminine presence on the American stage. Those are complicated threads there. Tease a few of them out for me.
What happened in Lydia Thompson's first season in New York was that she and her troupe of four other British women and one man, performed these parodies of middlebrow and high culture. In her performance, there was also a lot of singing. Songs were given, new lyrics in performance, very topical jokes, and above all, puns.
Double entendres, that kind of thing?
Not really double entendres, but the material, even for an 1868 audience, was fairly mild.
Mm-hmm.
No one, initially at least, commented upon the vulgarity of the performance. Even the very staid New York Times found the performance to be unobjectionable.
So there was no necessary sexual dimension or erotic dimension to any of this?
Not overtly at all.
Uh-huh.
Although the very presence of
the
women,
seeds are being sown,
who were regarded as very attractive.
Yeah.
One of the women in Lydia Thompson's troupe, Pauline Markham, was described as the most beautifully formed woman ever to have appeared on the stage.
Talk about PR.
Exactly, yes. And she did, Lydia Thompson's troupe did use PR. She had an advance man come to New York 2 months before she arrived. But the very presence on the New York stage of women in somewhat abbreviated costumes, although certainly no more abbreviated than ballet costumes were for the period, performing male roles, spouting these outrageous puns, and using streetwise slang in their act, both fascinated and troubled bourgeois male culture in New York in 1868.
Well, how did society, high or low, react to this? My sense is that there would have been, you know, we would have had moral cops on the beat saying, nope, we got to get rid of this stuff. Am I right?
Eventually, that certainly came to pass. For the first 2 months that Lydia Thompson performed in New York City in September, October 1868, at this little family theater that was connected to a menagerie in New York City, which is not odd for the period. P.T. Barnum had started the trend in New York several decades before. But these theaters were known for their wholesome, middle-class entertainment, a place where women could go and not leave with their respectability tainted. The reviews of Lydia Thompson and her troupe were, for the most part, quite laudatory, and certainly she attracted to Wood's Theater more people than had ever crossed the threshold before. Wood's made more money in September and October than any other theater in New York City. After Christmas, Lydia Thompson's troupe moved to a much more upmarket, prestigious venue in New York City, Niblo's Garden, which is probably the most prestigious theater in America.
Well, now, bring me back to this business of inversion and subordination. How do we move from this? What you're describing here, Bobby Allen, sounds utterly respectable. Where do we find the impetus for this inversion stuff that's going on here in burlesque?
What happens is when Lydia Thompson moves to Niblo, she moves into the public spotlight in a way that she never would have if she'd stayed at this little backwater theater on 30th and Broadway.
And therefore becomes accountable in a way that she wouldn't have been
otherwise. She certainly attracts the attention of ministers and the custodians of public morality, right, and even suffragettes. By the time she ended her very successful season in New York City in May of 1869, she had incurred the wrath of most of the newspapers in New York City. One minister had launched a particular diatribe against the troupe. Olive Logan, who was an actress herself and spokesman for the suffrage movement in New York City, had excoriated burlesque and said that so long as these painted-faced, padded-limbed creatures continued to be on the stage, that the stage was not a respectable career for a young woman in America.
It sounds like the Puritans criticizing Elizabethan drama.
It's certainly a legacy of part of that, as I would argue in the book. The business about inversion and transgression, I think, is important here because it is the transgressiveness of what Lydia Thompson and her troupe was doing, a transgressiveness that is produced through her inversion of sex roles. Lydia Thompson's performances had been enormously successful, but also enormously controversial. When she toured in Chicago in the summer of 1869, the press reportage of her performances in Chicago was so severe that she waited for the editor of a local Chicago paper outside his office.
Oh, yeah, went and beat him up.
She horsewhipped him.
Oh, my goodness.
She said it was the only way that she had to defend her honor. Burlesque is a very interesting instance of the way in which larger cultural debates and controversies and contradictions come to be acted out playfully within the realm of theater.
The role of women. Should women be heard and seen, for example?
In particular, yes. Burlesque reactivates fears about the theater and really the role of the theater in American society that are very deeply embedded in American culture. The Puritans, you were mentioning before, had no great use for theater at all, and in fact it wasn't until almost the beginning of the 18th century that the first play was legally performed in Boston. Until the 1850s, it would have been assumed that any woman on stage was a prostitute. And indeed, it would have been the case that most women in the auditorium in a theater in America were indeed prostitutes. Theaters were built from the 1820s on with third balconies that were there to serve as places of assignation for whole brothels full of prostitutes. And theater managers made as much money off of their connections with prostitution as they did customers coming in to see the play on the stage. All of this unrespectable, all of these unrespectable qualities of American theater had been gradually eliminated by the 1850s. And by the period after the Civil War, theater had become respectable. It was a place where both men and middle-class women could go. And even around 1868, 1869, women were beginning to go to theatrical matinees unaccompanied by men for the first time.
The program is Soundings, Conversations and Commentary from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Our topic is popular entertainment and the rise of burlesque in 19th century America. My guest is Robert Allen, a professor of radio, television, and motion pictures at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Robert Allen's new book is Horrible Prettiness, an account of burlesque and American culture, published earlier this year by the University of North Carolina Press.
Were there observers, critics, people who participated in the phenomenon of burlesque, Bobby Allen, who said, wait a minute, we are about to destroy ourselves. We're planting the seeds of our own destruction. Or was that simply not a part of what was going on?
Certainly, the discourse on burlesque moves rapidly from the criticism of burlesque as a theatrical form to criticism of burlesque as an infectious social disease.
This would be what? Newspaper critics, people like that?
Newspaper critics,
ministers,
other people who felt obliged to comment upon public moral issues and had the vehicle of newspapers or a podium or a pulpit from which to speak. Lydia Thompson's husband, Alexander Henderson, was also her manager. And in one theatrical trade paper in the spring of 1869, it was not implied but made fairly explicit that the relationship between Alexander Henderson and the members of his troops was one of a pimp to his prostitutes. That's the way the relationship was presented. Mm-hmm. Alexander Henderson was called the shovel-nosed shark in a sea of vice.
Oh, my goodness.
Lydia Thompson and her troupe and other burlesquers were characterized as literally an infectious disease that had been brought to American shores from Europe and threatened to infect American society.
I'm surprised in light of that kind of strong criticism that burlesque took as long as it did to decline, or that it lasted as long as it did.
It lasted only because it was shunted outside of bourgeois culture.
Not to mention the fact that people were making money on it, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah. And into working class culture. Uh-huh. It's this ambivalence of fascination and repulsion that's at work in burlesque. And you can see it in the discourse on burlesque. Oh. Although burlesque pretty well disappears from the scene of public discourse after 1870, except when burlesque threatens once again to emerge within middle-class culture. As long as it's kept in the tenderloin,
right,
where the working class live and entertain themselves, it's off in the shadows and of not great concern to individuals in bourgeois culture.
Well, that accounts for your title, Bobby
Horrible
Allen.
Prettiness. Horrible,
horrible prettiness is a phrase you pull from William Dean Howells.
William Dean Howells observed a burlesque performance in the summer of 1869. And he said, speaking of the women he saw on the stage who were playing male roles, he said they were not women, but they were as unlike men, constituting an alien sex in their horrible prettiness. And it's that combination of fascination and repulsion, I think, that characterizes certainly the public reaction to burlesque in the 1860s and continues to be a part of what burlesque meant to American culture through the latter half of the 19th century.
Well, apropos of that, let's talk about the legacy of burlesque, Bobby Allen. You use names in your book here toward the end of this book. You mentioned Bette Midler. You mentioned Roseanne Barr. It occurred to me to put earlier, Josephine Baker, maybe, later, Madonna on that
Sophie
list.
Sophie Tucker.
Sophie Tucker, Mae West.
Yes.
What about it? Burlesque is alive, even though it isn't taking the same form that you write about in this book.
The transgressive spirit of Lydia Thompson's 1868-1869 burlesque is still, I think, very much a part of the tradition of the representation of gender on the American stage. Mm-hmm. What happened to women on the burlesque stage as burlesque became an autonomous entertainment form in the latter part of the 19th century, is that burlesque performers quite literally lost their voices. The thing that was so transgressive about Lydia Thompson is that she was taking on the character of a man and making fun of masculinity.
Who silenced her?
She was silenced figuratively by the reorientation of burlesque to a working class male audience, so that burlesque's appeals became to center on the spectacularly displayed female body almost entirely.
You've got the objectification of the body without the insolence, without the inversion, without the condescension and the argument, the words, in effect, coming out of the mouths of these women.
That's right. Burlesque verbal component, increasingly toward the end of the 19th century, becomes a male preserve.
Uh-huh.
Male comics in burlesque say funny things. Women in burlesque become something to be looked at. First in the cooch dance that came out of the Chicago World's Fair of 1893.
Which is basically the belly dance.
The belly dance.
Yeah.
The shimmy in the teens, eventually the striptease in the 1920s. And women become something to be funny about. They mm-hmm. become the butt of jokes rather than the jokesters themselves.
What about the connection between... I don't want to leave this thread. We were talking about Madonna and Roseanne. Let's come back to that in just a moment. But give me a parenthetical comment, Bobby Allen. What about burlesque and pornography? I mean, that you've been, in a way, describing that relationship here for the past moment or two.
Well, one way of looking...
Too strong to force that connection?
Well, one can make the argument that burlesque... inaugurates a tradition of popular entertainment that is structured around the revelation of the female body
mm-hmm.
and the sexualization and objectification of the female body. And it doesn't take too much of a leap to see what's going on with the cooch dance or the belly dance or the shimmy as leading to, through the striptease, the ultimate objectification of the female form in cinematic pornography.
Mm-hmm. You got the stag film, but that isn't necessarily the same as pornography, nor is it the same as burlesque. It's a kind of an intermediary stage there?
Yes, it is, and it operates somewhat differently from hardcore pornography does today. But the other side of burlesque, and the side that you can argue doesn't lead to pornography, but leads to something else that's quite different in its political inflection, is female performers whose acts are structured around their unruliness, their transgressiveness.
Oh, that's Madonna.
Their inversion
sure.
of accepted norms of gender relations.
Mm-hmm.
You can see this in performers, black blues performers, Ma Rainey and Ethel Waters and Bessie Smith in the 1920s and 30s. You can see it in Sophie Tucker. You can see it, I think, in Mae West. Not so much her film performances, but her stage plays, which she wrote and acted in herself in the late 1920s. It is a tradition of women who comment upon their position in gender power relations.
All right. Now, you mentioned black performers. Is it too much to include somebody like Whoopi Goldberg? I mean, here we have do we have to force a racial component into the mix when we talk about what constitutes and how we account for burlesque?
One of the things that's interesting in following out this tradition of transgressiveness that leads from Lydia Thompson through to Bette Midler is that in many cases historically, these unruly female performers were women who, for one reason or another, were disqualified as objects of sexual desire
uh-huh.
by a middle-class white male audience.
Well, there's Mae West. I mean, who you point out in the book that she isn't particularly erotic or sexual, and yet she is the embodiment of burlesque.
She is the embodiment of a certain kind of transgressive sexuality. Uh-huh. Mae West has to keep reminding us how desirable she is. But even right. to a greater degree, in performers like Sophie Tucker or Bessie Smith or Ethel Waters, their disqualification as sexual object has to do with the yoking together of their transgressiveness with another category of sexual undesirability, that is undesirability seen from a white male middle class perspective. So Sophie Tucker is very ethnic, Jewish,
uh-huh, uh-huh.
she's overweight, she's right. not particularly attractive in the discourse about her. Bessie Smith and the black blues performers are disqualified by their race. It is in Mae West where you find a character who is on the edges of the kind of sexual desirability, and it is that it is the fact that she proposes herself as an object of sexual desire that gets her into trouble. Gets her into trouble in her films. Her films have to be toned down.
Right.
Gets her into even greater trouble in her stage performances. She wrote and produced one play in New York City in 1927 for which she spent 10 days on Rikers Island in jail. She was convicted of a morals violation.
And then she left him enough money to start a library.
To start a library. The one thing she complained about is scratchy cotton underwear. What I argue in the book is that these two sides of burlesque, that is sexual objectification on the one hand, and transgressiveness, unruly feminine transgressiveness, get unhinged in burlesque.
Uh-huh.
Burlesque, by the time it reaches the 20th century, in the 20s and 30s, women have become mute objects of sexual display. But that spirit of transgressiveness in burlesque is continued outside the form itself, in Sophie Tucker, Mae West, and I would argue characters like, performers like Bette Midler and Roseanne Barr, and perhaps Whoopi Goldberg. Certainly in Whoopi Goldberg and Bette Midler's and Roseanne Barr's other earlier stand-up comedy. Yeah. It was much raunchier, much more sexually explicit. Bette Midler's now making films for Walt Disney, so she's been toned down quite a bit. But I think that spirit still survives, and you can even make the case for someone like Madonna as representing that unruly, transgressive character.
Robert Allen teaches in the Department of Radio, Television, and Motion Pictures at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Robert Allen is the author of Speaking of Soap Operas and the editor of Channels of Discourse, a critical anthology about television. His new book is Horrible Prettiness, Burlesque and American Culture, published earlier this year by the University of North Carolina Press. It's Soundings, a program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings on Burlesque and American Culture is available on cassette. For a copy of the preceding program, send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 587. That's program number 587. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete listing of Soundings discussions available on cassettes, and when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center is eager to hear your comments about Soundings.
You've been listening to Soundings, a program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Next week, listen for conversations about literature and society in the Soviet Union. Wayne Pond will talk with scholars from the University of Pittsburgh, Duke University, and the University of Southern California. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Please join us again next week at this time on this radio station. Partial support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Burlesque and American Culture, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Listen for Robert Allen of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Robert Allen discusses his new book, Horrible Prettiness, an account of burlesque and American culture. Burlesque changed popular entertainment in America. It also affected middle-class values and popular perceptions of women and femininity. Burlesque and American Culture, this week on Soundings.